Hello, my name is Martin. Welcome back to another video. I'm here at a World Heritage site. We're going to look today at the
Ponchasilty
Aqueduct. Right, I struggle saying that. I'm not going to say it anymore because it's an insult to the Welsh people and the Welsh language. So I'm going to refer to it from now on as the aqueduct. But it's a World Heritage site. Look at it. It's there. It's absolutely amazing. We've got Ant here from the YouTube channel Trekking and Exploration. So today we've been invited by the Canal and River Trust to go beyond the gates and take a look at the aqueduct in its drained state and trying to see how Telford designed it and how he put it together. It's a very unique thing. It's only drained once every 10 or 20 years, this. So we're very privileged. So let's go beyond the gates. So here we go. Once every 10, 20 years. I'll be dead when they do this again. Look at that. One small step for a man, one giant leap for Martin Zero. This is incredible to be down here in the actual trough. So the first thing I wanted to show you was the stop boards that are holding back the rest of the canal. They've put stop boards in here, seal it with ash, believe it or not, and they hold back the canal. And then as we walk in where normally it would be full of water, we're basically in a cast iron tank built in segments that is also bolted together. If we look down here, you can see the bolted sections together. It's actually a very simple design, to be honest with you. So I actually thought when we came here, I was always terrified of this aqueduct because of the height. And you see the boats going over and you stand on the edge of a boat, you hear the drop below is terrifying. Because it's 5'3" deep, yeah. I've not actually had to suffer the views, although the views are fantastic, but I've not actually, my vertigo's not kicked in.
So this week we're in North Wales, and the nearest town to the aqueduct is Wrexham. So this is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and the Canal and River Trust are custodians of this wonderful structure, and I'm very grateful that we've been invited along today to take a look at it. The aqueduct spans the River Dee. It was constructed over 10 years between 1795 and 1805 during the canal building frenzy. It's 336 yards long, 12 foot wide and 5'3" deep. It's 126 foot high. It's basically a cast iron trough supported on arched iron ribs and carried on 18 stone pillars.
Right, come and look at this. You see how it's bolted together here. 11,000 bolts in the aqueduct, and there's one of them there. We actually get to see part of the way it's constructed, and this will be repeated all along the piers, the stone piers. So I'm going to give you a close-up now of that, and then you'll know how the ironwork fits to the stone, and it'll give you an idea of construction and what it's like. And I've got, I've got some drawings that will show you how that is all fitted up. You can see that it's actually hollow underneath, and obviously that makes it nice and lightweight, reduces the weight on the piers.
But who do you get to build such a massive project as the canal, the aqueduct, and all the associated earthworks? Well, a dream team was put together. And that team, and I'm reading notes, was Thomas Telford, as you may know, but there was other engineers involved as well. William Jessop. Now, it sounds like William Jessop was a little bit older and a little bit more experienced than Thomas Telford. And they kind of worked together and very much respected each other. But for the aqueduct, who would provide the metalwork for such a project? Well, there was a gentleman called William Hazeldean, and he was a master of ironwork, and he got the contract to provide all the ironwork. And John Simpson was the chief masonry contractor. So those four names became the dream team to build the aqueduct. Now, all these four men were very, very well educated and masters in their field. It was very, very much a group effort, and they all had a mutual respect for each other. And although Telford's name is mentioned with the aqueduct, it was very much down to these four men. William Jessop seems to be in a consultancy role. He was an older gentleman, and he was the master canal engineer at the time. They were very grounded, and they had quite a quite a concern for the people that would be working on the project, the guys up top doing the masonry work and the iron work, and of course not forgetting the navvies that would actually do all the digging work and everything. I'll give an example of the sort of like the spirit of Thomas Telford. I'll quote you this. Now imagine Thomas Telford, he's got multiple projects going on around the country, and he had to travel and visit them, and probably on horseback or horse and cart at the time. So this is an account of when they stayed at a port inn, so when he paid the bill. When Mr. Telford paid the bill, he gave the poor girl who had been a waiter, chambermaid and probably cook-in-chief a 20 shillings bill. I shall never forget the sudden expression of her countenance and her eyes when she understood it was for herself. So there you go, he's obviously paid somebody very handsomely for their services, a very poor person. And I just wanted to tell you that story because I wanted to put a humanity and give you an maybe even though a small insight into the nature of the people that we're talking about that built this wonderful structure. Right, so there you go. There's the towpath. This is where the public would normally walk. You can see the painting work here being done. This would terrify me. I think it would terrify me if I was on a boat on that side. Look at the views, and you can see the valley here that they had to span from that side over to this side. So this is Mark Abraham from the Canal and River Trust, construction manager. Mark, what is the purpose of the work on the aqueduct?
So what we're doing actually today, this is all part of a grand maintenance scheme throughout. So what we're looking at doing, so over the past 4 or 5 years, what I've been looking at, we've been replacing the handrails on the side, because obviously the handrails, like everything else, need maintaining. So due to the stoppage season, our main works are done between October right through to March. The aspect of this time round is this is for a principal inspection. So we're actually dewatering the whole lot to look at the bolts and all the mechanics and all the ironwork to see what grade it is. We will then take patterns from those bolts. There's 11,000 bolts in here, and then we'll make a decision of what we're going to replace. Whatever we replace, we've got to try and make good and put back for future generations and do it forward. So each time we take a bolt or a stay, we'll then find out what material that's made, and then we'll actually literally get a shopping list. So when we come back in 2026, and mention dewater again, we've got everything on the shelf ready to be fitted with the correct permissions as we do it.
Brilliant. So as you can see, this side looks like it's concrete here. It's actually not, that'll just be a coating of mud and silt that's on it. It looks like it's spraycrete, but it's not. And every couple of feet, as you can see here, we've got the joins between the, what I want to call the tank, basically, the trough. So as you see, it's joined up here every so often, and we have to step over it. And you can see here, there's big, huge bolts.
There you go, you can see the bolts better in this footage here. Now, as you can see, the arrangement is this tank that we're in was bolted together in segments. So how do you make those segments watertight in 1795/1805, you know, in that around about that era? What did they do to make it watertight? Well, it's fascinating. So what they did, they had to use at the time what they had. And what they did was they took Welsh flannel, which was obviously a material, and they dipped it in boiling sugar. I presume this made it extremely sticky and tacky, and they put that in between the sections of tank, and they bolted it up tight together, and it all must have set, and it made a watertight seal, which I think, as far as I'm aware, is still working today. Some accounts that you look at, it'll say it was Welsh flannel with white lead and iron particles. So I presume, I'm guessing they tried various methods, but hey-ho, it's still watertight today.
So the towpath now is obviously iron, it's metal. This used to be a wooden towpath, and if you can imagine back in the day, all the workers that used to come across here and horses pulling boats across here.
You may have noticed these wrought iron loops just on the floor of the tank. They were to do with the original wooden towpath. They're now redundant, but that's what they're for. John Simpson, the stonemason, used golden limestone for the project. Quarried nearby, it was said to be of an excellent quality.
Imagine how deep they go down, the foundations for them, sat on the bedrock probably. So Mark, I've seen pictures online of a big plug hole, and we were looking just down here at sort of like a mechanism. Could you tell us how you drain the water from the aqueduct?
Yeah, so this time what we did is actually the sock planks are put in either side and we used man-made pumps.
Now, as Mark says, even though this time they used pumps to pump out the aqueduct, they have in the past used a plug hole, which would be a spectacular thing to see. While we were there, said plug hole was being looked at and they were doing maintenance on it so that perhaps next time they drain the aqueduct, they can use it. So this is the guys from the Canal and River Trust doing some maintenance on the, I call it plug hole for want of a better word. So there you go. And one of the things they've got to think about before they use that plug hole is they've got to test the water in the tank, in the aqueduct, to make sure there's no contaminants, because you don't want to drop anything down into the River Dee down below that might contaminate it.
So obviously when the canal came to the valley here, it was a daunting task. What do you do? How do you get a canal across this valley, across the Dee Valley? Well, initially they were going to build a set of locks down the valley and build a lower level aqueduct. They went with that for a while, but Thomas Telford had a lot of faith in his ideas. Mathematically, he'd worked it all out. He'd worked out the materials and he decided that he could build an aqueduct at a higher level and make the canal uninterrupted across the valley, and that's what they wanted. It was called the Stream in the Sky when it was finished. And so rather than the locks that would have hindered the process of the goods going across the valley, he built his aqueduct.
So even today we marvel and splendour at the aqueduct. I think it's a wonderful thing, but we aren't the only ones that appreciate it. Throughout history it's been appreciated and it's been admired. The Scottish novelist Sir Walter Scott declared it the most impressive work of art I have ever seen, and the American writer Washington Irving called it stupendous. Engineers and scientists were equally impressed. In 1816, the French engineer Charles Dupin called it something enchanted, a supreme work of architecture, elegant and unadorned. The scientist Michael Faraday crossed the aqueduct in 1819, noting that it was too grand a thing to be hastily passed. The skills of British canal engineers were now sought overseas and all around the world. But let's not forget, although we admire it as a piece of art, why it was built. It was built for business and it was built to transport goods. The area was rich in coal, iron ore, clay, limestone and slate. And all this needed to be sold to the rest of the country, and then it had value. When they floated the shares in the canal, I'm not talking about the aqueduct now, I'm talking about the whole canal. When they floated the shares, everyone had to go down to Shrewsbury to buy shares. It was reported that that Shrewsbury, the night before the meeting to buy shares, was so crowded that accommodation was very difficult to come by. Several gentlemen being obliged to take care of their own horses, cook their own meals and sleep two or three in a bed. My God, the shame.
Well, this is what I love about round here, because all the oldie worldy things, look at this. Look at the way it's been eroded or worn down, because loads of people over the years have done this. But hey.
Now, although we haven't got James here to make a brew, we did find a very, very nice tea room just across from the aqueduct.
It's the chapel, but it's actual aqueduct tea rooms, which is very nice. And it's very civilised here. We're having a pot of tea for two.
Filter coffee.
This is called Barab something. It's like Welsh fruit bread.
Barab
some. Yeah, well, we won't try and offend everyone in Wales.
Roy's
having a French coffee, French filter coffee. He likes that. Where's James when you need him, eh?
I know. Missing out, James. Slap up meal.
James, slap up meal.
Yeah. In order to get the stone down into the valley, a counterbalanced tram road was constructed. As the piers got higher, they also constructed these wooden walkways in the sky. It must have been absolutely terrifying working up there, and obviously no safety ropes or anything like that. This concern for safety was reflected in a letter that William Jessop wrote to Thomas Telford in 1795. He writes, "In looking forward to the time when we shall be laying the iron trough on the piers, I foresee some difficulties that appear to me formidable. In the first place, I see the men giddy and terrified in laying stones with such an immense depth underneath them. And apparently one man fell." Now, they prided themselves that only one man fell during the whole construction. Some reports you read, they say no men fell, but apparently, according to what I'm reading, somebody did fall off one of the piers. Now, the trough just sits on top of the ribs, and it's not fixed to them. It's just prevented by lugs and its own weight from moving sideways and coming off altogether. Also, when you look in detail, you'll see lug holes on the non-handrail side of the aqueduct. And that is just because all these plates were just built identically. So it didn't matter which side of the trough they went on.
So, Mark, the aqueduct, over 200 years old. You're an engineer. What do you think about the condition of the structure and how does it stand today?
Yeah, it's very good. I mean, if you look at it, you look at the bolts and you can actually see. So you see some bolts in here that's 200 years old. And I say to him, look, how do you get a comparison? How do you grade it? Simple thing, you look at one that's 200 years old, you look at one that's in 2003 or in between. There's one bolt on there, you can see, and it's degrading. But that's degraded over 200 years. So if that bolt beside it is only 60, 70 years, you can say, that's got another 100 years to go. So it's almost partly guesswork, but you can physically see it from the erosion of the actual bolt from bolt to bolt. We've got some bolts in here that's 200 years, and you can actually see that one is better than the other. What's that caused by? Didn't have quality control back 200 years, so each one is going to have its own characteristics. But when you look at the ones that have been replaced over a period of years, you can almost grade them by years. And you think, look, that was put in recently, that's looking good. That one's 200 years old, still looking good. So you can grade them, so that's got another 40, 50 years in, that's got another 10 years in it. As we're growing and evolving, we're trying to make sure that whatever we put back in there is as original as possible.
Wow. So you can actually age a bolt.
Yeah, age of bolts.
Fantastic.
Age of bolts.
An incredible fact, even 16 years after the aqueduct was built, Thomas Telford wrote a letter, and in it he said, "We are very vexed at the fact that there is still settlement in the columns. So even though we've used the finest grit and we've put the foundations right down onto the bedrock, there is still settlement." And it must have been, on inspections, it must have been causing a little bit, or they saw movement. And so 16 years after, the entire thing was still moving and settling. Okay, so this is Mark Summerfield, Heritage Advisor. Mark, I've got a very, very geeky question for you.
Okay, fire away.
I do understand that most of the aqueduct is cast iron.
That's right.
However, there is some wrought iron in it.
Yep.
Where in this structure would you use wrought iron, and why would they use the combination of two?
So you would use wrought iron in places where you need malleable material. So essentially, things like the stays were wrought iron, not the uprights, but the stays that hold them in place, because wrought iron is stronger but flexible. So it's made of fibres of metal, so it's stronger and flexible.
Yeah.
So where you needed the metal to kind of have some give, then that would be the case.
Got you.
The panels are cast iron because you couldn't make these panels at that scale. It's a new technology, so you were making cast iron panels at this size to ensure that you could build this very big Meccano kit and then bolt it together when you got it to site.
Mm-hmm.
All this was made just down the road there and then brought to the site in bits and then bolted together, just like it would have been a Meccano set.
Supplied by Mr. Hazeldine, is that correct?
That's right. That's the O.
Is that original?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And if you look along, you'll find a number one, a number two, a number three, a number four, and they are component parts that were marked so they knew exactly where they would go when they got on site, bolted them together.
Well,
just like Meccano.
That is incredible. Thank you very much.
That's all right.
Now, much of that Meccano set, and indeed a lot of the masonry, would have been put together or worked on here, a place called Trevor Basin, just beyond the aqueduct. This would have been a kind of like goods inn section of the building site.
This was where the kind of like the hub of all the activity. So a lot of stone got brought here, was cut, and then was got just sent down a short way down there to the aqueduct. So 1795 onwards to 1805, this would have been a hive of activity. And no doubt Mr. Telford and his various associates would have strolled down here, inspecting the work that was taking place.
And then just off the basin is this, which had us very confused. Went inside it, just filled in at one end. It was a spur off the basin, and it went off, I think, to a works. Now, I'm not going to go into that, but here it is on the old maps. It was a spur off the basin. Maintenance. Can you imagine the costs of maintaining and keeping this structure in pristine condition? The Canal and River Trust are custodians of this UNESCO World Heritage Site, and they want to see it obviously survive for generations to see. And I'm in love with the thing now as well. There is a crowdfunder, because the Canal and River Trust are a charity and they are trying to raise some money to do the work, the necessary work that needs to be done. If you feel like dropping a couple of quid, you can do. I'll drop the link to the crowdfunder in the description to this video, and I'll pin it in the first comment on this video as well. I've left them a few quid, and I think I get a little certificate to say that I'm a minor stakeholder in the aqueduct. Well, it's been a fantastic opportunity to visit and see the work going on and to see the aqueduct in its drained state, and I have to thank the Canal and River Trust for inviting me along. All that's left for me to do is take a walk along that towpath in summer probably and admire the views, because we were so concerned with what was going on down in the tank. I actually never walked the full length of the towpath, so I still need to do that. I need to go back and do that. I might do it on a warm summer day. And if anyone's sailing over there, I should very much like to hitch a ride and experience what it's like to look down from your canal boat on that side of the aqueduct. So give me a shout if you're sailing across.
Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. I would like to thank the Canal and River Trust for inviting us down and getting us to do that once in a decade opportunity, wasn't it? Thank you very much for watching. Take care. We'll see you in the next video. Bye for now.